From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to take a look at President Trump's habit of talking about the greatest economy ever, the most growth ever, the biggest boom we ever had, lowest unemployment. There's now a Democrat out there, a prominent Democrat, big Biden supporter, Biden advisor, actually, who says by the time of the election, Trump could be bragging again about the rate of economic growth. The market is up again today, another 300 points. There is optimism about an economic recovery. We'll talk about that. Is the optimism justified? What could interrupt it? And this apparently is a huge, gigantic fear for the Biden campaign. The fact that the economic recovery could happen so quickly and so dramatically, it would sweep Trump into an easy reelection. We will get to that coming right up. We will also be speaking to David Brooks. He has a number one New York Times bestseller. No, really. It's called The Second Mountain. And it basically is about how America needs a spiritual change, more emphasis on community, caring for other people, relationships, family. Okay, what happens with that after the pandemic? We'll be talking to David Brooks, author of The Second Mountain. We'll also be talking to Alex Barazel of the American Council for Science and Health. What about the fears of a second wave? Those fears are serious. And could they occur and disrupt everything? What is the likelihood? Where is the smart modeling right now? The numbers, one of the reasons the market's up is the numbers of deaths for the United States are way down. And this despite the fact that we are opening up in most parts of the country. The level of death is the lowest it's been since March. That's very good news. We'll talk about that with Alex Barazel. And we will also speak about the president's demands, which are drawing a great deal of, it seems to me, very well-justified criticism. His demands for the investigation of a very prominent media figure for murder. I mean, really? We'll get to that as well on the Medved Show. Do you have 11 cents? I mean, this is one of those things where if you dropped 11 cents out of your pocket with one of your exercise walks, would you notice it? No, but you will notice it if you spend that 11 cents to get a subscription to our MedHead membership, which also gives you 50% off on anything from the MedVed History Store in download. We have this spring sale going on. It's going to end by the time it is formally summer, which is coming up, believe it or not. But right now, you can get $20 off. You sign up, it only costs you $40 for a full year subscription. And that gives you access to the show 24/7 in commercial-free downloadable form. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner, and use the promo code SPRING40. To take advantage of this sale. It is going away, but it's a great benefit right now. And speaking of great benefit right now, I don't think there's any question that the Politico piece by Ryan Lizza and Daniel Lipman, Politico leans left, like most of media do. But this is a piece that will bring a smile and encouragement to any Republican. It certainly has already attracted attention, very positive attention, from the Trump administration. The piece begins in early April. Jason Furman, remember him? I do. He was a fairly persuasive Obama advisor who is now a Harvard professor, and he was a top economist for Barack Obama. And in early April, about 6 weeks ago, Furman was speaking via Zoom, of course, to a large bipartisan group of top officials from both parties. And he said the following: We are about to see the best economic data we have seen in the history of the United States of America. No, not the worst. He said the best economic data. Everyone looked puzzled and thought I had misspoken, Furman said. Instead of forecasting a prolonged depression-level economic catastrophe, Furman laid out a detailed case for why the months preceding the November election could offer Trump the chance to brag truthfully about the most explosive monthly employment numbers and gross domestic product growth ever, ever. Okay, if that comes true, that prediction by a prominent Democratic economist, former advisor to President Obama, do you think President Trump would be heavily favored to win re-election? Of course, there's no telling what he's going to do. There's no telling what Joe Biden is going to do. Joe Biden's kind of coming out of the witness protection program a little bit. We'll get to that as well. But they write in Politico, Furman's counterintuitive pitch has caused some Democrats, especially Obama alumni, to panic. A former Obama White House official who was still close to the former president said, "This is my big worry. The level of concern among top party officials," he said, "it's high, 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 high." That's four highs. Okay. They're concerned that America might make a too quick recovery. Well, at least they're honest. But let me tell you something. I think for anyone, for political reasons, to vote against or to root against a very rapid national recovery, a rapid national recovery is what we all want. And it's what's necessary. And by the way, that rapid recovery will help the health of America as well. Because that kind of recovery is only going to come across if we continue to at least hold the line, if not bring down the level of death and illness even further. We have to do that. We are doing it. I think that the path that we seem to be on in most states, including blue states, red states, has been fairly effective. So do the economic experts who are cited in this Politico piece. Furman's case, writes the Politico, begins with the premise that the 2020 pandemic triggered economic collapse is categorically different from the Great Depression or the Great Recession, which both had slow grinding recoveries. Instead, Furman believes the way to think about the current economic drop-off, at least in the first two phases, is more like what happens to a thriving economy during and after a natural disaster. A quick and steep decline in economic activity followed by a quick and steep rebound. In other words, it's a famous V-shaped recovery, not a U-shaped recovery, not where you're down there at the bottom for a while. You're right back up and back up almost as dramatically as the path downward. Starting around April 15th, when economic reopening started to spread, but the overall numbers still look grim, Furman noticed some data that pointed to the kind of recovery that economists often see after a hurricane or an industry-wide catastrophe like the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. The bounce back can be, he says, very, very fast because people go back to their original job. They get called back from furlough. You put the lights back on in your business. Given how many people were furloughed and how many businesses were closed, you can get a big jump out of that, says Jason Furman. It will look like a V. Okay, so what happens to that V if we have a second wave? We will get to that. We'll be talking about that with Dr. Alex Barrazzo, microbiologist, and more coming up on The MedVed Show. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. On the Michael Medved Show, talking about the coming financial boom. Now, the question here, and everybody's asking this, is, look, we've heard about these epic losses. We've lost 36 million jobs. The numbers are astonishing. But one of the points that I think they make, and it's very smart, in this Politico piece by Ryan Lizza and Daniel Lipman, is that when the election comes, and it's coming, ready or not, here we come, it's 5 months from now. When the election comes, people are not going to measure the state of the nation based upon, well, how are we doing compared to where we were in, oh, say, December, November of 2019. People are going to be experiencing, how are we doing right now compared to where we were in, oh, say, April or May of 2020? And the chances for at least a short-term, very vigorous recovery with gigantic growth. Now, what's fascinating about this is it's not just President Trump who is saying that we're going to have a very, very brisk growth rate. Because if you take a look at the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, Congressional Budget Office, what they see for the third quarter, okay, just to put this in perspective, a third quarter is September, August, and July. Those months, they're coming up. They see a growth rate on an annualized basis in the third quarter as 21.5%. That is the strongest quarter, if that comes true, in the history of the country. We've never had that equivalent. Now, it would be coming right after a terrible quarter for our overall economic growth, which is the second quarter, which we're in right now. And yes, the second quarter includes the month of June. So we're not looking for an immediate turnaround. But if we are anything like a 21% growth rate, do you know what that'll feel like? When the announcements come every month, and usually the announcement comes the first Friday of a new month about the unemployment rate, if it's getting better and better and better, do you know what that's going to feel like? And what the Democrats are saying is, hey, Biden, you better get a message here other than Trump is no good and he screwed everything up. Because that's not a winning message if all of a sudden, as mainstream economists and Democratic economists expect and the Congressional Budget Office expect, if all of a sudden you really are undergoing this very, very vigorous growth. Is there something that could screw it up? Yes, there is. What is it? Just listen. The Furman's argument, writes the Politico, and they're talking about Jason Furman, former senior economist for the Obama administration. He's now a professor at Harvard. Furman's argument is not that different from the one made by White House economic advisors and by Trump himself, who predicted an explosive third quarter. And senior advisor Jared Kushner, who said a couple of weeks ago, quote, the hope is that by the July, the company's really cooking again. White House officials were thrilled to hear that some of their views have been endorsed by prominent Democrats. They spoke at Politico to Larry Kudlow. What do you think Larry Kudlow said? He said, I totally agree. The third quarter may be the single best GDP quarter, and that means a GOP quarter, since regular data. Second half, super big growth, transitioning to 4% or more in 2021. Kudlow called Jason Furman, usually a straight shooter. Hats off to him. Okay, fine. And Kevin Hassett, another top Trump economic advisor, said, I've been saying that on TV as well. If CBO is correct, we'll see the strongest quarter in history after the weakest in the second quarter. Now, they point out in this article, a rebound won't mean that Trump has solved many underlying problems. Since the crisis started, many employers have gone bankrupt. Others have used the pandemic to downsize. Consumption and travel will likely remain much lower. Millions of people in industries like hospitality and tourism will need to find new jobs in new industries. The scenario would be a major long-term problem for any president. But before that reality sets in, they write, Trump could be poised to benefit from the dramatic numbers produced during the partial rebound phase that is likely to coincide perfectly with the 4 months before November. That realization has many Democrats spooked. And make you happy to see some Democrats spooked? In absolute terms, the economy will look historically terrible come November, said Kenneth Baer, a Democratic strategist who worked in a senior role at the OMB under Obama. But relative to the depths of April, the economy is sure to be on an upswing. 12% unemployment, for example, is a lot better than 20%. But it's historically terrible. On Election Day, we Democrats need voters to ask themselves, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The Republicans are going to be asking voters, are you better off than you were 4 months ago? And I think that's smart. I think that's true. But first of all, America doesn't like whiners. America doesn't like people who are pessimists, who are gloom and doom merchants. That's why they rejected Jimmy Carter and they embraced Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was talking optimism. And if we have a 21% growth in the quarter just before the election, in those months, July, August, September, if we have 21% growth in those months, could anyone, any candidate or any combination of candidates, whoever Biden appoints to be his vice presidential running mate, could they possibly beat him? The former White House official, unidentified, who we talked to, Democratic official, Obama official, he says, even today, when we're at over 20 million unemployed, Trump gets high marks on the economy. So I can't imagine what it looks like when things go in the other direction. I don't think this is a challenge for the Biden campaign. This is the challenge for the Biden campaign. If they can't figure this out, they should all just go home. Between now and Election Day, writes Politico, there will be five monthly jobs reports which are released on the first Friday of every month. The June report covering May is likely to show another increase in unemployment. But after that, Jason Furman predicts, if reopening continues, the next four reports could be blockbusters. You could easily have 1 to 2 million jobs created every month in those four reports before November, he said. He added, then toward the end of October, we'll get GDP growth for the third quarter at an annualized rate, and it could be double-digit positive economic growth. Those will be the best job and growth reports ever. There's only one major caveat. If there's a second wave of the virus and a really serious set of lockdowns, I wouldn't expect to see this. So what's the chance of a second wave of the virus? We'll talk to microbiologist Alex Barrazo from the American Council for Science and Health coming right up. On the Michael Medved Show, it's always a pleasure to welcome back my friend, Dr. Alex Barrazo. He is a microbiologist. He's a science writer, and he specializes in debunking junk science for the American Council on Science and Health. You can read all about his work and about their work to go to our website. We're linked to the American Council for Science and Health. Alex was also the founding editor of Real Clear Science. Okay, Alex, we're just talking about the great likelihood, which is now being conceded by the Congressional Budget Office, by Democratic economists, by Republican economists, by everybody, that if we continue with this gradual opening up that we're going through, the third quarter economically could be the best quarter in all of American history with a growth rate of over 12% on an annualized basis. Okay, if that happens, it's a huge boost to President Trump. The Politico is saying, and I think they're right, the only thing that could louse this up would be a major second wave of the pandemic that would force new, stricter, tougher lockdowns. How likely is that, in your opinion, Dr. Barzal, looking ahead?
Unfortunately, Michael, I think it's really likely. And the reason I say that is because a report that came out of the University of Minnesota analyzed 8 of the previous major influenza pandemics. And this goes back to the 1700s. And the authors concluded that of 7 out of these 8 major pandemics, there was a major second wave that was bigger, deadlier, nastier than the first wave. Now, that's influenza. That's not coronavirus. But coronavirus and influenza share a lot of characteristics in common. They're very easily transmitted. They transmit through the air. And it seems that everybody is susceptible. And if that's the case, history predicts a second wave.
And predicts a second wave about when? It's right in October, right before the election, right?
great timing if you're a Trump supporter, right? Yeah, it's about 6 months. And so we would be seeing something coming back in the fall. And, you know, it's not a guarantee, but history can be informative. And unfortunately, pandemics, when there's a new virus that nobody's ever seen before, when that sweeps through the population, it usually takes about 18 to 24 months to finally sort of burn out and become seasonal. And so that's what we're looking at. We're looking at dealing with this virus for quite some time.
So what's the best way to deal with it? I mean, in other words, if obviously President Trump and every patriotic American, I don't care whether you support Trump or Biden or anybody else, you want America to emerge from this nightmare. What's the best thing that public officials could be doing right now to deaden the impact of what, you're not the only one who says it, but you've said it very forcefully, about the likely second wave? What can we do to ward off its impact so it's not devastating?
Right. So I think that a blunt instrument like a lockdown is just devastating. And there are reports actually coming out now. There was an influential article in The Hill, which by several professors, who said that the lockdown is actually costing more lives than it's saving. And the reason is because you have to think of all the people who are cancer patients who are now not getting chemotherapy. Think of all the new cases of cancer that are not being detected because people are too afraid to go to the doctor. Think of suicide, drug addiction, all the things associated with economic downturns. And they say that the lockdown is actually killing more people than it's saving, but through blocking the infection. So we can't do that. It's too devastating. So I favor a targeted approach where we encourage older people to stay home or to practice social distancing. We all should practice some sort of social distancing, wear masks, wash our hands a lot. Right here in Poland, I just went into a McDonald's, and there is a guy standing there making everybody use hand sanitizer when they walk in. And so, you know, things like that. We're going to be a little bit intrusive, I think, but we simply cannot shut down the economy because the side effects of that are just too devastating.
Okay, just to shift on this, in the midst of the pandemic, you have a great piece we've posted on our website about Steven Pinker. And he's been a guest on the show many times.
And I like him a lot.
I do, too, and I appreciate his general optimism, which is the truth, about the fact that civilization is getting better, not worse, that your chances of living a fulfilling, long, healthy life are enormously higher today than they were 50 years ago, or let alone 500 years ago. However, he made a statement recently blaming evangelicals for some of the problems with the coronavirus. And he also said that it was because they believed in a malignant delusion called the afterlife, to which, as a scientist, you say, Alex Barazow?
Objectively false. And this is not a commentary on whether or not religion is true. I'm a religious person myself. I know you are, Michael. This is not a commentary about whether religion's true. The commentary is on whether or not religion provides health benefits for people. And the answer is unequivocally yes. And there's a pile of research that shows that religious people tend to be happier, more civically engaged. They have mental health that's better, and they're able to cope with life stresses better. And so the idea that religion is somehow bad, no, it's just not supported by the research. And that was a real rare misstep by somebody who I respect and I think really ought to know better on this topic.
Yeah, and again, you cite in your article the fact that there is such an abundant of wealth of research concerning the benefits of not just religious belief, but of religious practice. I'm going to be reviewing a new movie coming out called Screened Out, which is a very powerful film about the dangers of being addicted to screens, which many Americans are. But they make the point that what you need to do is take a break from screens, which my immediate thought was, oh, that's why God created the Sabbath, right?
So, you know, I will say that as a Christian, practicing the Sabbath is not as big of a deal in Christian circles as it is in Orthodox Jewish circles. And I will tell you that when I decide that I will set aside Sunday and do nothing except just enjoy life and not work, my whole week changes. I look forward to Sunday. And that's a lesson I learned by visiting your home, Michael.
Well, thank you. You're kind to say so. But it's one of those very basic areas in which I think the message that far from being a malignant delusion, a religion really is good for you. What about in terms of length of relationships and satisfactory family relationships? What does the research say there, Dr. Barazow?
Well, I know you know this topic a lot better than I do, but I will go ahead and venture a guess, and that would be that people who are in religion, people who are religious, have longer, more successful marriages and relationships.
And by the way, particularly when you're engaged in a community. Because, and this is the one thing that has been driven home to me by all of my life experience, when you're in a community setting, then you're not, it's not just you and your wife and your immediate family, or you and your husband and your immediate family, who care about the future of the couple. It's all of a sudden all kinds of other people, and maybe even the Almighty himself, who are invested in the survival of that link. So what about the survival of the homeless problem, a COVID-related homeless crisis? Where? We'll tell you coming up.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
Michael Medved Show, there's a headline, and the headline is from the San Francisco Chronicle, so you know where it's going. The headline is San Francisco homeless deaths soar, and officials say it's not directly due to COVID-19. The story says the number of homeless people in San Francisco who died over a recent eight-week period spiked compared to the same time last year, an increase that officials say was likely driven not by COVID-19, but by drug overdoses, underlying medical conditions, and a disruption to shelter and services due to the coronavirus pandemic. 48 homeless people, an average of six every week, died in San Francisco between March 30th and May 24th. While the deaths did not appear to be directly related to COVID-19, the numbers suggest that disruptions to services and shelter caused by the pandemic may have been a contributing factor, as Evan said in an interview with the Chronicle. Look, the crazy thing about this is San Francisco, for a variety of reasons, has so far at least come out relatively okay in the coronavirus crisis. However, unless they do something about this homeless disaster, and it's as bad in San Francisco as it is in LA or Seattle or anywhere, and those would be probably your big three worst cities for the homeless population. And unless something is done about this long term, the disease is going to, find an obvious place to spread. Do you think they're practicing social distancing effectively in some of these encampments that are up there? They obviously aren't. And this brings me to a column, and I'd like to have the author on. His name is Tim Burgess. He's a former member of the Seattle City Council. He's a former cop. And he's sane. That's why I think he's a former member of the City Council, which is an insane place right now. And it turns out that three Seattle City Council members, he writes in a column today in the Seattle Times, Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, and the unspeakable Shama Swant, want to permit tent encampments almost everywhere throughout the city. He writes, this ill-conceived, very dangerous legislation would effectively allow camping all across Seattle, including on sidewalks, as long as campers leave a 4-foot accessible pathway. Campers would also be allowed on planting strips, anywhere in parks, open spaces, and industrial lands. Astonishingly, the council members even want to block police officers from removing encampments when someone calls police seeking removal of campers. This proposal is wrong for three very significant reasons. Actually, I could perhaps think of 30. But the first two here, it seems to me, bear repeating, and they go to the very, very heart of what is so terribly wrong with the city treatment of this issue. It says, first, allowing camping everywhere is not a solution to homelessness. The proposed law, in effect during the COVID-19 civil emergency, won't move one person, not one person, into a safe and warm home or provide services the person may need and want. Nearly unfettered camping across the city at this proposed law would do is inhumane. It helps no one escape homelessness and risks continued harm to campers and to neighbors and to the city itself. In other words, allowing more camping doesn't do anything to solve problems. It just rewards people for perpetuating those problems. It makes it easier for people to live on the street. Why would you do that? Second, the proposed law perpetuates a common misperception, the belief that all unsheltered people have the same desires, expectations, and willingness to accept help. They aren't all the same. Many repeatedly refuse help. We know that. Some who are living in the hundreds of local ad hoc encampments are engaged in criminal behaviors, murder, rape, aggravated assault, theft, burglary, narcotics trafficking, and yes, arson. The city government has extensive documentation of these crimes. This is extraordinary. And again, it is insane to try to reward people who live that way. The police cleared two encampments in the Chinatown International District last week after a woman was murdered, after a shooting, and spikes in assaults, thefts, burglaries, and fires. The proposed ordinance would have blocked the police from taking the reasonable step to protect public safety and clearing up the encampment. Let's go to RJ in Olympia, Washington. You're on the Michael Medved Show.
Yeah, Mike, I've been listening to you all week, and you keep getting people that come up on your show, and they keep making comments to the effect that, whoa, boy, Trump's sure in trouble if the coronavirus comes back. Maybe you could explain to me why, as a citizen and a voter, why I would think for 5 seconds to blame Donald Trump for a virus that came out of China that he's tried to put under bay, and I've sat here and watched for the last 4 months Democrats try to pretend that it doesn't exist all the way till it was effective for them as a political weapon. Why I would ever think for 5 seconds to blame Trump for that? Maybe you can explain that to me, because that's what I
can hear. Explain it. No, I can explain it to you very easily, RJ. It's not fair. You're right. President Trump, if we come out of the coronavirus well, President Trump deserves some credit because he was there. And if we don't come out of it well, he will get, whether he deserves it or not, some blame, because that's what happens to presidents. Look, Jimmy Carter, I think, was a terrible president. He had exactly the wrong tone. But if you look at his policies did not actually cause the economic horrors of the late 1970s. That was caused by the Arab oil boycott. It was caused by a whole range of different factors. Jimmy Carter wasn't really to blame, but of course he got blamed, because when you're president, if you're president during some kind of economic disaster, you're going to get blamed. And the problem about this second outbreak is it's hard to imagine that if we all of a sudden have soaring death rates again, that confidence and the stock market and investment and business growth will all be booming. It probably won't. Now, that doesn't mean that President Trump couldn't do a better job. I think one of the things that he's going to have to focus on is focus, is actually not getting distracted. We're going to talk later about President Trump's extremely foolish and self-destructive obsession with Joe Scarborough. I mean, it's crazy. I know Joe Scarborough's a big anti-Trumper. So what? But to accuse a guy who is very prominent, a former U.S. congressman, and I believe he is now a former Republican, to accuse him of murder in a case that was looked at by the authorities in Florida it's 19 years ago. It's not really the ideal strategy. We will also be speaking about another president. His name is Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, who actually won his bones as a president and won the hearts of the American people by his handling of a very different kind of economic crisis. And he did so in confrontation and ultimately in cooperation with a notorious leader of American industry and banking. We will get to that. There's a new book about the fateful hour, about exactly how that worked out. And we'll also be speaking to David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times. He was hired as a conservative columnist for the New York Times. But his new book is not political. It's spiritual and inspirational and aspirational, actually. It is about what happens once Americans find their basic needs satisfied. You've set up a life, you've set up a career, you've set up a family. So what happens next? The Second Mountain is the name of the book. We'll climb that peak with David Brooks coming up. And we'll talk further about the politics of the moment, and which way we go from here. That and much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.